Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, she's a street skater's street skater, and right now she's dominating the Olympic qualifier series. We're talking to Fernandina Beach skateboard champ Poe Pinson about her rise from Grom to greatness. Later in the program, a cultural resurgence in Nassau County aims to meet the population boom where it lives. But first, fresh off her stunning performance at the Olympic street skating qualifiers in Shanghai, we welcome Poe Pinson. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Poe's dad and staunchest supporter, Kenny Pinson. Good morning, Kenny.
Good morning, and thank you for having us.
Oh, we're delighted to have you.
Pleasure.
So, Poe, let's start with your recent trip, because you really must still be a little jet-lagged.
Yeah, just a bit, but...
You got back from Shanghai Monday night?
I believe so. I've honestly got my days all mixed
it was
up.
Monday
but,
night.
Okay, yeah.
Monday
he
night.
Probably knows better than me.
And so how was the event?
It actually went pretty good. I was... Beforehand, I was kind of feeling... I guess just a little over it as a whole, I guess, just because, I don't know, there was a lot, because I've been filming stuff for Nike SB, and there's this rule about advertising where I wasn't going to be able to be in the video for Nike SB that was going to premiere at the Olympics because I was going to be in it, but that's kind of getting sorted out, and then there was another video that I wasn't going to be in, so I was like, oh, this is all... just kind of a mess. But I talked to one of the coaches, and she was kind of just telling me to, whatever, it's like a once in a lifetime opportunity, may as well go ahead and try my best. So it honestly went pretty well. We had a few days there beforehand, so I got to hang out and skate the streets with my friends, and then same thing, the contest, I surprisingly wasn't really too nervous. I was kind of just like, oh, whatever, this is just gonna go how it goes. Then ended up qualifying pretty well. And then the next round, landed all my stuff, somehow ended up qualifying into the next round. And then I was kind of just like, well, okay, well, may as well just give it my all. And then I ended up getting fourth, which is the best I've ever done at one of these events. So
wow. That's extraordinary.
Kind of crazy.
Congrats. Kenny, it's my understanding that you were the one who bought Poe her first skateboard.
Yeah, it was like a Walmart. Kmart board, kind of inferior. But yeah, I didn't want to go big money wise. But she came to me immediately and said, Dad, she pushed it around and it just went in circles. And I said, okay, you made your point.
She was how old?
About 4 years old. That's she for her fourth birthday. That's what she wanted to do, go to the skate park. She didn't want anything, any presents. That was her present. And, So we went to the skate park, and she's written her own story.
And so she took to it pretty much right away.
Yeah. It's been an amazing adventure with her because you could just tell the way she walked and skated. I put a tennis racket in her hand at about the same time she got on a board, which was about two and a half. And I was more tennis inclined, but when I saw her on the skateboard, it just eclipsed anything I thought about.
She actually got on her first board at two?
Yeah, at two. She ran over a little plastic ramp. I was holding her hand in our neighborhood. These little kids were out there on it, and they said, hey, you want to try it? To Poe, and Poe, of course, little daredevil that she is, she said, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
And she did it.
So, Poe, you really got going, I guess, a little bit after four. I mean, you started competing really early.
I was about to ask him. When I was six, I did, what was that, just like a
local comps?
Yeah, I feel like up until, everything was kind of just local up until.
Kona, you went to Kona Skate Park.
Yeah.
That's here in Jacksonville, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then she went down to Cocoa Beach and won in bowl.
I didn't even bother with the street division.
You just street. That's right, exactly.
And you're 19 now.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about how these games are structured, because skateboarding is still kind of new to the Olympics. This will just be the second time that it's been an event, and they split up street skating from park skating. So explain to us, what is the difference between those two events?
So okay, street. I mean, it's basically, so it's like gender and discipline. So there's like female street, whatever, like anyway. And so park is kind of like a bowl, I guess, like kind of just empty swimming pool vibe, except it's like actually designed for skating. And then street is things that are more incorporated in the actual streets, like handrails, stair sets, like just gaps, stuff like that, banks. But it's, I mean, both of them obviously are skate parks, but yeah, I don't really, park is a little bit more intense, honestly, just from my friends who compete in park. I hear some things, but yeah, street for sure, especially like women's street. There's like a really good vibe. I mean, everyone that's like kind of on top right now is younger than me. Like it's really insane. Like I was reading one of the like press releases or whatever from the competition, and I got called the eldest finalist.
Wow.
I was like, oh. But yeah, it's kind of, I know how street's judged. It's kind of, I guess it's judged kind of the same. It's really hard to judge just because it's a very, like, I guess, I don't know. It can just be, everyone has their preferences on who they like to watch skate. It's like some people are like, wow, this person actually is like the best skater ever, but I don't like the way they like really look on a skateboard. So it's like, I don't know. Everyone has their own opinions and stuff. So I guess for that, you can't really like put points on tricks. But in like the sports side of it, competition, it's kind of based on consistency, execution, and like, I don't know. For what I go for, I try and go for like the amount of tricks I can fit into a run, like diversity too. Like you can't just have like four of the same trick in your 45-second run. It's kind of got to be, yeah.
One of the things that's interesting, too, is that, I mean, it's certainly with this street skating portion, it sounds like there is sometimes not an expectation but an understanding that you're not always going to hit your trick. Like, you may fall. And that necessarily happens with the understanding that it's because you're doing such really difficult tricks.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you have 45 seconds to land. I don't really even remember how many tricks are in my run in Shanghai, but to land, say,
average,
say like 8 tricks. So you have 45 seconds to land 8 tricks, and you get two tries to do that. So it's kind of, there's the window's pretty small. But then compared to other sports, like we were watching the speed climbing and stuff, they just have to scale this wall as fast as they can. It all comes down to like milliseconds. But yeah, I mean, for skating, it's kind of, it's, yeah, I'm always just happy if I land my run. I'm kind of just like, oh, like I landed my run, sweet. But yeah, it's kind of crazy what it can kind of come down to, just the focusing on one thing at a time, and breathing's really important.
Huh. Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking with Team USA street skater Pope Hinson of Fernandina Beach and her father Kenny about the path to the Olympics this June. You can join our conversation on air by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. We have a call from Charles on the West Side. Good morning, Charles. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Oh, it's so nice to hear about you, Poe. I was going to ask you what your, whether you did the street or whether it was on a prepared course, but you already answered that. But, you know, it's amazing the technology has come so far. My first skateboard back in the the mid-60s was, we sawed our own board, and then we screwed on the wheels from roller skates onto the that was our first skateboards back then. But it's so nice. Good luck on your run, and it was so great and inspiring to hear from you this morning.
Thanks, Charles.
Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you so much.
If you are watching, you know, we do live stream now on Facebook and YouTube. We do have Poe's current skateboard in house, not the one that her dad gave her from Walmart, but the one that she's actually using currently. We'll have a shot of that to show you Anything special about this board that you have, you know, added or done, or anything that you particularly require in the board that you use?
Not really. I kind of, my setup's kind of crazy. I ride a pretty short wheelbase. It's like a 13.38 inch wheelbase, which is pretty short. I feel like the average is like 14.25.
Is that the, like, the distance between the wheel and the board, or between
the
wheels?
That one's between, so there's like the trucks and the wheels and the deck. It's kind of where the trucks sit on the deck, like how far apart. And then there's the length of the board too. But I feel like nothing really special. I ride kind of bigger wheels, like size 58 wheels, which is, I feel like usually more park and vert skaters ride bigger wheels like that. But I kind of like them. And then ride pretty loose trucks too. But then, yeah, 8.25 width skateboard. So pretty standard.
And you're goofy footed, is that right?
Yes.
Tell us what that is.
Goofy footed, it's basically just when you have your right foot forward and your left foot back. I don't know. Some people try and say that if you kick a ball with your right foot, you should be regular footed, but I don't know. I kick a ball with my right foot and I ride goofy. So,
all right. Kenny, I want to ask you, I mean, you had Poe kind of late in life.
Right. Yeah. In my early 50s.
In your early 50s. How has that, if at all, how has your age affected your parenting of Poe?
It's a good question. Maturity, maybe. Me being more mature than I would have been had I had her in my early 20s or something, or late 20s. And able to coalesce into the upbringing. I worked in archaeology at the time in the restaurant business. After I had her, I was working part-time. And so I was very focused with her. And that was a big part of her upbringing, just being in tune with her.
Mm-hmm. And you have actually written a book together, which
yeah.
I think is pretty cool. Tell us about how that came together.
It's called Click and Poe. It's about a click beetle. And we interacted with that little beetle for a couple of hours until we lost it into the thickets. We just put it away and couldn't find it again.
In real life?
In real life, right. In real life, yeah.
Poe was playing with her.
Yeah,
you, okay.
Yeah, she's the one who found it. I mean, yeah, she was just close to the ground, you know, where it was tooling around outside, and she found it, and she said, "Look, Dad." And I didn't know what it was at the time. It was a beetle of some sort, but I didn't know it was a click beetle. But we discovered it, and it was just like click and flip. And so we just got a major amount of joy out of watching this little critter. And I fell in love with it, and just it kind of evolved out of our interactions. So the book was written from that experience.
Was this the first time you had thought about writing a book?
With Poe, yeah. And you know, I've got other ideas with her skateboarding. I've got a book already started. I'm hoping she'll kind of like just take it over, take the pressure off me.
Is it a children's book as well?
It's a children's book, yeah.
So what's the story of Poe and Click, Poe?
I don't really know. I feel like I didn't really have that big of a part in it, honestly.
You kind of inspired it more than...
Yeah.
Right. She was inspiration, and I went to her with a lot of technical ideas about the writing and the art. The art was very important because it was done by Lee Cohen. And
who's Lee Cohen?
He's a friend of mine. He's a skateboarder too. And he did the artwork. I met him, and he had all these little cool stickers of different things. And we just kind of like became good friends through all of that. And
so he agreed to do the drawings?
Yeah, so he agreed to do the drawings.
We have a question from Jim via email, Poe. He says, "We think about Olympians as training relentlessly for years. What is a training day like for you?"
Well, for me, training, I guess, I guess I don't really train like on my board. There are some things where I'll kind of keep things in mind, or this goes just for like anything in skating. If I have an idea just for a trick that I want to try on something, I can kind of try it on. So if I, in this most recent contest, for example, I did like a gap back 5-0 on this rail. I was really scared, but I did like back 5-0s on like all the other rails that were there. Just
and explain
to kinda
what
get
that
ready.
Looks like. What does that look like to an observer?
So I guess it's kind of, you're on your back truck, which is the metal thing holding the wheels, and you pop, you like, I guess, jump with your back facing the rail, and then you set it down on top of the rail on your back truck, and then kind of pinch it and hope for the best. Yeah. But yeah, I guess training.
And then, then you're sliding along this rail, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you go up backwards, and are you riding it backwards?
No. You're riding it. It's just with you're riding it normally, but then just with your back facing the rail, and you pop up and put it on your back truck. So you're kind of in like a wheelie position on the rail, basically.
Gotcha.
And then, yeah, come off. But I guess training, I don't really train on my board. I guess I can kind of visualize different things. If I want to try a trick, I do it on other things, and just, this goes for like just filming too in the streets. Like, I guess you can just visualize that, but I don't really train. I know some people do like train pretty hardcore, but I'm not really cut out for all that. I work with the trainer, Melani. She's great. I've been seeing her since I was 14. Cause I mean, skating's hard on your body. It's not good for your body. So I just try and keep up with that. I have a lot of back issues and knee stuff. So
yeah, let's talk about injuries. I mean, I was saying that one of the reasons that the Olympics was somewhat resistant to introducing skateboarding in the first place was because the IOC didn't want to take on the liability of the possibility of severe injury. The page in the Olympics said, you know, even death, which was a surprise to me. But I guess you can get terrible head injuries. So what is your history of injuries?
I've been lucky enough not to have too many like brutal acute injuries, especially like not so far, but I still have like a lingering bone bruise in my knee, kind of on the top of my fibula. And then, cause there was one instance I like twisted my knee up kind of bad. I actually have a video of it. It honestly looks way worse than it actually ended up being. I thought I had torn something right away. It was really weird, but I got an MRI. It turns out I just strained my MCL and then had a like pretty gnarly bone bruise. The orthopedic doctor said he's really surprised I didn't like break my leg entirely, but I guess that kind of goes to just with doing a lot of like preventative stuff with my trainer and just athletic training, so to speak, just to prepare my body for getting slammed on the concrete, basically. And then it was kind of weird. It kind of worked its way up. So before that too, I had kind of jammed my ankles up pretty bad. I like hot pocket, or just kind of my dorsiflexion on like the top of my foot, I jammed that up pretty bad. Then that took a few months to heal. Right as that was healing, I sprained my ankle pretty bad. That took a few more months. And then sprained my other ankle pretty bad. That took a few more months. Then after that was all good, that's when I hurt my knee. Couldn't skate for a few months because of that. And then about like last summer, I would say, everything was kind of good by then. But then my back kind of started hurting. So then that kind of just like escalated. Then I actually hurt my back when I was in Portugal on a skate trip. And then so I got MRIs for that and stuff. And turns out I have just like arthritis in all of my L vertebrae and then my S1. And then I have like a degenerative disc disease. I'm pretty sure genetics might have to do with this too. But, and then I have like 3 herniated discs, I'm pretty sure.
Wow.
Yeah. So kind of got a lot going on, but it's all pretty manageable as long as I'm like taking care of my body. But
is that, I mean, you were an alternate for the 2020 Olympics, and now you're on Team USA, you know, heading towards Paris. But all of these injuries happening as you're going through the steps towards that eventual competition.
Yeah.
That makes it difficult.
Yeah, it does. I've missed, it's kind of weird because I guess I honestly kind of got lucky in a way because I've missed like 3 of the contests from this, I guess,
Olympic segment.
But it was kind of the same thing last time. I did well because it works in a weird way. It's kind of a point system. So different competitions, I'm not sure why they do this, but are worth different amounts of points. So I missed for example, in like this most recent one, I missed like the first World Championships, and then that kind of like set me pretty behind. I was like, whatever, I don't know, I didn't really think too hard about it. And then I did pretty good at the next one, but it was only a pro tour stop, so it was worth like a third of the points that the World Championship one was worth. And then same thing, I missed the next stop, but that was just a pro tour stop. And then the next one in Tokyo was like a world, not the Olympics, but there was another separate one in Tokyo. That one was a World Championships, and I did all right. I didn't really do too well, but I got like 20 something, which is all right. But then that gave me some points, and then I missed another pro tour stop in Dubai this like recent February. There was just too much going on for me to go. I had so many other things. I was like in New Zealand. It was overlapping. It was a lot. But somehow I was still kind of in an all right position, like ranked like 24th in the world, I think.
Wow.
I don't know how that managed to stay, but yeah, then this most recent one bumped me up to like 9th in the world.
Wow.
So
yeah,
I don't know. It's kind of crazy how it all unfolded, just because so much injury and just, yeah.
Well, we're talking to skateboard champ Hope Hinson from Fernandina Beach on her way to the Olympics. So, Kenny, what has to happen for her now between now and the June Olympics in order for everything to fall into place?
Our physical trainers, and then just her mindset, working with skating every day and just being disciplined.
There's one more round of qualifying, though?
Yeah, there's Budapest. All that
Budapest.
Part. Yeah.
Yeah, it's
and what
yeah.
needs to happen there?
I guess I just like don't have to, like, as long as I don't blow it, I should be pretty good.
No yeah. injuries. Yeah, we're hoping for the best.
Yeah, if I just do decent in Budapest, I should be going. So yeah.
In your for your gender and your sport, which is the street skating, they have three U.S. Contenders that they'll send.
Yeah, so. I still don't really honestly understand how it all works, but I think it's like top 20 and then the country quota is 3.
Okay.
So
I mean, what does it mean to you to think about being an Olympian, being there at the games and competing? Does that evoke any particular feeling in you?
I don't know. Kind of crazy, just because I never really even thought about it until... Even the last time, I didn't really even know that I was that close to going. So, I don't know. I guess it's kind of like a crazy feeling. Definitely very grateful, because some people like are born into this, especially seeing like people from other countries and stuff who really have to, like Japan, for example. They're already at like the max country quota for just these competitions. They have 6, and then all 6 of them are kind of like really competing for the top 3, and it's very, I see them getting kind of like, just I just see the hardships for other countries and stuff, so I feel pretty grateful that it's just like a thing where I'm kind of just like, wow, this is crazy that this is even like in reach at all. So yeah, because I mean, I didn't really start skating for that. It's not really one of my core values. I feel like I make most of the memories just by the people I meet and everything like that. So I don't know.
How about for you, Kenny? I mean, what do you envision her in Paris in this competition? What does it mean to you?
Never on our radar. But let me tell you an interesting story. There was a Clemson University couple who came down to the skate park on vacation at the beach where we live, Fernandina. And they looked at Poe. Saw me interacting with her, giving her water, whatnot. And they came and talked to me. And I said, yeah, well, go ahead and talk with Poe. And they came up and said, young lady, we're going to see you in the X Games. We're going to see you in the Olympics. And Poe was only like 6 or 7 at the time, way preceding the Olympic authorization of skateboarding.
And she was in the X Games too, right?
And she was in the X Games. That all came to fruition, you know, and... So for us, I mean, for me as a kid, it was always just the Olympics was some kind of dreamy thing that I watched on television, and for Poe to have the opportunity to compete was just way beyond me in terms of thinking and dreaming, you know, as a family.
And we hear, you know, Poe saying, I mean, she's going to Hungary, she's been to China, just got back from Shanghai, she's been to Dubai, she's been to New Zealand.
Italy, wow.
Are you able to go with her at all on those places?
Yeah, I traveled to Italy with her and to Japan, two places that
Brazil.
I never dreamt of being with my daughter. And Brazil, oh yeah, Brazil. That's right, yeah. And it was just an amazing thing to watch my daughter perform under those circumstances.
And so what do you foresee for you in terms of being in Paris for these for this competition? It's in June. Let's see. Is it
late July for the Olympics?
Yeah.
Yeah. Late July to August. It ends on
I'm
my
sorry,
birthday.
July 28th. Is that right?
I think that's when it begins.
Be around there.
And it ends on my birthday, the 11th of August. Mm-hmm. Kind of funny.
So you would plan on being there?
Yeah. I won't miss Paris.
Yeah. So you also, I mean, you have other sports that you like to do. You surf.
Honestly, surfing, I'm not too good at.
Okay.
Surprisingly, for living real close to the beach and stuff, I'm all right. I can kind of paddle into a wave and stand up and stuff. But I feel like, yeah, no, skating's mostly just been. I had never really played sports in school. I mean, I played like kickball and stuff at like recess, but. I got really into golf, right before my back started hurting when my knee was hurt. I started playing a lot of golf, maybe too much golf, which kind of contributed to my back pain. Mm-hmm. But so I started at the beginning of the year and then I played until the summer. And I was like, I don't know. I don't know what it is about it, because before I started playing golf, I was kind of just like, oh, golf's kind of like. Stupid, whatever, this and that. But then I started playing golf and I was like, all right, I see now why people are obsessed with this. Yeah.
You've tasted the addiction.
Yeah, it's kind of weird.
We still hit tennis too.
Yeah, I like tennis. I mean, yeah, but mostly skating's just kind of always been like, oh, why would I go do this when I could skate? Or I did gymnastics for a while when I was young too, but that kind of happened through skating. I met my gymnastics teacher at the skate park.
That's funny. All right.
Yeah.
That's funny.
So and, Hungary, Budapest, Hungary, June 20th through 30th, and then Paris in July. I hope you keep us up to date with your progress. And it's really fun to talk to you both about this path to the Olympics. It's really excellent, Poe. It's nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you too. Thank
Kenny,
you.
Kenny, thanks for making the trip down and talking to us about Poe.
Thank you for having us. It's been a pleasure.
All right, up next, a cultural resurgence in Nassau County's Mid and West Side. Welcome back. Well, Nassau County is one of the state's fastest growing, and the art scene is doing its best to meet those residents where they live. To talk about that effort, I'm joined by Richard Restiano, president of the Nassau Council of Arts and Culture. Hey, Richard.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Very well. And Tony D'Amico, founder and managing director of Blue Fire Theater. Hey, Tony.
Good morning.
Good morning. So, Richard, how are the arts changing in Nassau County?
Well, it's not so much that it's changing. What's happening is we see the opportunity growing because of, as you mentioned, the fastest growing county, is bringing in a lot of diverse people that have different interests and different passions about what part of the arts they're really interested in. And so, you know, coming from a group that's been 15 years island-centric in the traditional arts form of theater and dance and music, we look at this as an opportunity to kind of open up the county to understand you may have a different point of view in Callahan and Hilliard than the kind of thing we're doing down here. We want to make sure that we have arts for everyone in this county.
So for people who don't know the geography in their head of Nassau County, it's almost like Georgia, where there's like a little bit of, well, not a little bit, but there's a smaller part of coastline. And then there's just this giant west area. And it really stretches basically from like Folkston, Georgia to McClenny in Baker County, Florida. So it's an enormous swath of land and includes a lot of, you know, rural areas and places that I don't think people necessarily, Tony, associate with arts and culture.
Correct. You know, a lot of folks have grown up in the rural area, so they didn't necessarily grow up with the arts and culture. It wasn't something that they were doing as they were growing up. You know, they were doing more agricultural type activities outside, fishing, hunting, you know, hanging outside and doing that kind of thing. So I use an example of when we first, our first show that we did in 2019, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, we had a couple that had lived in Nassau County the entire time, their entire lives, and they were in their 40s and they'd never been to a live performance before.
Oh, wow.
And so it was the first time they'd ever been to something. So yes, it is. It's very, despite the growth, it's still very rural in areas.
I think of, I mean, there's a lot of industry there that has traditionally been, you know, there's Rayonier is a big interest there. They're a logging and paper mill that's in downtown Fernandina. And then they have its chemical arm that they just spun off. They also have Radiant Places, which is Wildlight, which is a massive 24,000 acre development that's going to have 24,000 homes eventually.
Exactly. Right.
By comparison, I mean, Nocatee in St. John's County is only 1,400 acres. This is 2,400 acres. It's really going to change the entire landscape, Richard.
Yes.
How do the arts, you know, address that kind of massive change and development?
Well, you know, we have two basic constituents. We have the 25 or 26 arts not-for-profit organizations that we work with, and we also have the resident constituent. And so what we want to do is we want to balance the two of them and get one in front of the other. So the change that we see in the county population is going to drive us to have to recreate what arts and culture means to the rural communities. And if you look at the school programs, which we also support, one of our not-for-profit organizations is Arts Alive, which goes into all the elementary schools in the county and provides arts and music after school. You know, we see that as, you know, the real beginning of how you can connect with a group of people that may not know who you are. You do it through your children and you help them appreciate and understand what art is.
You recently revisioned and kind of reformed the Arts Council in Nassau County. Explain to us why that was necessary and functionally how it changed the way that the Arts Council operates.
Well, we were a sort of like a quasi-county commission, and it was in existence for 15 years. And the commission, from the county point of view, said, we recognize we need to have a proactive position on arts and culture. So we'll go into Fernandina Beach and we'll use the 7 or 8 arts organizations, pick somebody from those groups and set them up as the arts board. And so what happened for the last 15 years is the arts organizations themselves were the board members of a countywide effort to bring arts and culture forward. They were pretty much dedicated to working through their own programs, which were island-centric. So the county really was left out of a lot of this kind of movement, opportunity, as you can say, to get arts really up in front of everybody. Other than the Arts Alive program, which Jane Lindbergh had started years back, bringing the arts into the schools, it was pretty limited countywide. So after being on the chair for that group for the last 3 years, we went to our own board, and we had a kind of come to Jesus meeting that said, if we're really going to be a county thing, driven by the fact that you're going to put, you know, 29,000 families or homes in mid county, what are you going to do from down here that's going to make a difference there? And they all decided, without the money, obviously, and without the opportunity and support of all the arts organizations, there was really no way we could make that effort happen. So they all voted unanimously, all 11, in December, to remove the county commission city program. I mean, we were working underneath the arts, the parks department in Fernandina.
So it was kind of an arm of city government in a way.
Yeah, it was. And it was totally restricted by, you know, the Sunshine Law, which means one of those members had to be at a meeting, even if I wanted to talk to three people. You know, nothing wrong with the laws and the system. It just wasn't going to work for what we needed to accomplish.
And so now it's what? It's a nonprofit. It's kind of its own entity.
Exactly.
But does it still have a board of directors? And
it does. Tony happens to be one of our board members.
Yep. The Nassau Council of Arts and Culture is the new name for the organization, and it is a 501c3 not-for-profit. And we feel like we talked about this and taking an example from the Cultural Council here in Jacksonville. I think we know we're probably never going to be quite as big as them. Our goal is to do some of the things that they do in Duval County, in Nassau County, and that is to provide more grants for the organizations. So we need to build those dollars out there, everybody in Nassau County, if you're listening. Mm-hmm. Buy those license plates, because that's where the Arts and Culture Council has always gotten a lot of their money from, is buying those license plates.
The arts license plates.
Right. State of the art.
Yeah. So that's the, if I'm not mistaken, that's the only license plate where the money comes back to the county where you bought it.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So if you buy an arts license plate in Nassau County, that money comes back to the arts and culture in Nassau County. So that's kind of one of the reasons we wanted to make it a not-for-profit as well, because we want to be able to provide some workshops for the organizations, bring people in to talk about how to better your boards, you know, how to raise funds if you're having a hard time, and, you know, just do some of those things that they do here in Jacksonville.
And tell us a little bit about Blue Fire. First of all, I'm curious where you got your name, but also where you are physically. You're a little bit nomadic right
yeah.
now.
Yes, we are. We started out, and part of the reason that we did this was to expand that cultural landscape in Nassau County and go west, you know. So because everything is a lot island centric. So there's no performing arts organization in the West now. And we are it now.
You are.
We are. And there's some arts and things of that nature. Like they have some classes and stuff in Hilliard. They have things like that over in that part. But there's really no performing arts in that section. So we've been in existence in 2018. We did our first show in 2019. We did it at FSCJ out there in Nassau County, right there by 95, and had to build our own stage and do all of that. And then, of course, we all know what happened. The pandemic came along and we had to shut it down. But we decided also that part of what we want to use our performing arts arm for in the county is to benefit the community through performing arts. So what we've tried to do with everything that we do is to have a giving component. So we try to give back to the community. We've had food drives for Gracie's Kitchen in Nassau County.
I saw that. And you also had a portion of tickets. You would donate $5 from every ticket sold to the
Soup
Kitchen.
Our Broadway and Brew. We've done that several times. Upcoming at the end of this year, we have two things that we're doing. One is for Pinky's Promise in Callahan. It is for October, which is Breast Cancer Awareness. Love, Loss, and What I Wore. It's a staged reading. And all of our proceeds outside of our expenses will go to Pinky's Promise. And she's a not-for-profit in Callahan that provides women with wigs, stuff that they need when they're going through chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second one will be Seussical the Musical, which will be a lot of fun. And we're going to involve the community very heavily in that one. And a portion of the proceeds are going to go to the Nassau Education Foundation. So
I'm going to steer you back. I'm curious, though, where the name came from.
Oh, it was an old Victorian slang. A friend of mine found it, and she brought it to us as we were trying to figure out a name. And it was the first time they used a material that made this blue glow, and everybody was like, oh, look at that. It's amazing. It's outstanding. And that's what we want to be. We want to amaze and astound our audiences.
Richard, what are you aiming for in the next couple of years? This growth is coming to Nassau County so quickly. And I guess you feel the need to kind of plant the flag at this point.
Using Tony's organization as sort of like the beginning of the growth piece. She's put her flag in the ground, and we're behind her. We're also working with, for instance, the Historic Council Society in Yulee. They have a historic council there. And we have helped them move forward with the idea that similar to how what they have in Jackson Beach, the museum park, which has got the old train station, the old locomotive. Well, Yulee is a wonderful opportunity for Wildlight and for us to kind of put some pride of place up there. As you drive up A1A and you come like right through it, you really don't know where you are. Oh, it's just Yulee, and you kind of drive through it. Here's a chance now, and we're so happy to be part of the effort to help that organization, together with Wildlight, take a look at what we can do to bring a historic living art history museum to place in Yulee. So I think while they're working with the Wildlight to get a piece of land, they already have some land from the county. They have identified the buildings. Angie McClellan, who is the president of that organization, is the granddaughter of Page's Dairy from the road Page's Dairy, which is right there. So she's got a vested family interest in making this happen. That's her mission. We're doing everything we can to support her and to make sure that all the people that are important to make this happen come together.
So this is an ongoing effort, obviously, and we'll be keeping track of it. Richard, anything that you want to add that people, if they want to get more involved?
Yeah, absolutely. We're in the process of building a board that needs to represent the whole county. So what we're really looking for in our goal is to, out of the five voting districts, bring one person who's got a vested interest, a love for the arts, but is definitely wanting to make an influence on their community, right? So that's part one. Part two is by moving into a nonprofit, we can open up the opportunities for donations, grants, and investments. And then ultimately, the 7 to 10 year goal is a performance venue mid-county.
Well, that'll be great. We'll be looking for that. Richard Restiano, Tony D'Amico, thank you so much for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Anne. We
thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Thanks for the time.
And stick around in just a minute. Storytelling with a springtime theme.
LifeSouth Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with LifeSouth helps save lives. More at LifeSouth.org to find a blood drive near you. Amelia Island supports National Travel and Tourism Week, May 19th through 25th, celebrating how the travel industry powers the economy, connects our people, creates job opportunities, and supports our community in Nassau County. Learn how at NassauTourismWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Crazy Rich Asians author Kevin Kwan has a new novel set among crazy English Asian aristocracy, so over the top.
There are beautiful jewelry designers, bespoke tailors, like Sartoria Ripense that makes beautifully tailored men's suits, the people that make the pillows for the Pope.
Next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Glenn Lowry is a renowned Black economist and conservative social critic. He often rails against identity politics. But in his new memoir, he explores everything that goes into crafting his own identity.
Are you sure you want to share all of that information with people? I can't imagine myself telling people those kinds of things about myself. A dear friend said to me, I read your book. I'm not sure I like that guy.
Glenn Lowry on the next On Point.
Today at 11 here on WJCT News 89.9.
Listening to the news can feel like a journey, and 1A is the place for daily conversation that guides you beyond the headlines. We bring together thoughtful guests and listeners from every state to help us take the pulse of America. I'm Jen White. We'll get to the heart of the story together on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, there's nothing like a good story, and my two guests are here to tell their story about the upcoming spring edition of Untold Stories. Joining me is the event's artistic director and host, Barbara Colicello. Hey, Barbara.
Hi.
Babs.
Morning.
And one of the featured storytellers, Mary Strickland. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
So, Barbara, this is the third season of Untold Stories. For listeners who may not be familiar with the series, briefly describe just what it's about.
Four times a year, we bring together six storytellers from Jacksonville, and the idea is for them to tell their lived experience and how it connects to Jacksonville. So my job of casting, you know, trying to find a diverse group of storytellers and trying to hit all the neighborhoods, get people listening to what is happening and what has happened and how Jacksonville, the place, has affected their journey. And the Florida Theater is the one that is producing it, and they feel it's a great way to bring people together over story. And it's not a lot of fanfare. It's just the people up there sharing what, you know, has happened.
Yeah. And this, you have kind of loose themes that people tell around. So this theme is spring.
Spring. Yeah. And it's so different. Spring is, the stories are so different than fall, than the last time, you know. Yeah, it's been fun working on spring.
So what is your favorite kind of story?
I love them all. So I can sit through something that's really dramatic. I look for stories that bring me there. You know, I teach that. Like, I want to go into the room, into the space with the person. So I love when people take me on the journey. Of course, it's, and I think in every situation, I love when people still can find the humor or the irony. I think that, you know, that happens when you have more time to reflect back on what happened to you. The story evolves, and you can just hear it in the telling.
Mary, you have done some interesting work with incarcerated women.
And, yes, that's true.
I'm curious. So you are a writer. Storytelling is a little different. How do you come to it?
Well, actually, I've been working with Women Writing for a Change, writing my own stories. And as you said, we used to work at the Community Transition Center in the jail, and we used to do the same program for the women there. And it was a lot of fun because they get to tell their stories. So I would read my stories out loud sometimes, and people would laugh. And someone said, you should maybe go over to Babs' lab and see what they're doing over there. So I went over to Babs' lab. I saw a story slam for the first time, and I thought, you know what? I want to try that. And so after a lot of thinking about it, I hopped up there and told a story, and it was just so much fun.
And you describe yourself as coming from an Irish Catholic family, fairly boisterous bunch of people.
Yeah, so I'm from a large family, six kids, and so a lot of the stories I tell are about my family, about my brothers and my mom, and we had six kids in 9 years, and it was a lot of rowdy kids. So there are a lot of good storytellers in my family as well.
So what are you going to be talking about at this upcoming Untold Stories?
Well, this particular one, I'm going to be talking about a specific job situation in Jacksonville. I don't want to reveal too much about it, but I have been here for quite a while, and I've worked here, so I'm going to talk about that.
Okay. So it sounds like, you know, Mary is a little bit more of a natural Babs in terms of being a storyteller that comes with that gift. But typically when you're dealing with somebody who's done some writing, how do you coach them into being a performance reader or a storyteller?
It's a process, and they have to be kind of committed to it. But it's I'm working with a new group right now. In fact, some of them are stand-up comics. Mm. You know, they're writing their material, and it's all about embodied storytelling. Someone was talking in her routine. She's talking about, you know, she's driving the car. She's picking up her son. And the way she's standing on the stage, she's very relaxed. And I said, no, I want to see you in the car. You're sitting in the car. You have a steering wheel. And see your son. Like, make the image. Put us there. So it's getting people out of their head and into their bodies. And we're just not used to being trained, you know, to use our bodies. Yeah. It's from everything's from the neck up.
Right. So what do you do with your hands?
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, once your hands, the gestures, we do movement, we do machines, we work with gesture, what gestures mean. Some people do nervous gestures and it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
So learning how to stand in your power, just going to your breath, simply standing there is scary. And so you have to practice. It's like you go to the gym or you do yoga. Being a really good communicator, you have to take the steps.
Wish we could talk really all day. I mean, I love talking to you about the storytelling work that you're doing. But this upcoming event is Thursday, May 30th at 7:30?
Yes.
At the Florida Theater?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the last one, fall, the Florida Theater always puts out a survey. And the response, the quotes we got back made me really happy. And so many people responded. So people are enjoying it.
It's a huge success. Well, Barbara Colicello, Mary Strickland, thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our program. We encourage your feedback and suggestions. You can send either to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock tonight or find our entire archive at wjct.org or on your favorite podcast platform. Join us tomorrow when we discuss balancing the need for both primary care doctors and subspecialty physicians. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.